I'm a first timer on Sarah Cole, a Kind of Love Story.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. We've got a special Valentine's Day episode for all the lovers and lonely voices out there. We're talking about Sarah Cole, A Type of Love Story by Russell Banks. Does everyone love a love story? How about the type of love story that might not be all hearts and flowers? People are complicated, and love can be too then. Sarah Cole, A Type of Love Story, is an unusual story in many ways. It is a type, a very peculiar kind of love story. It's strange and even kind of difficult to read because it's so unlike what we might expect from a typical sort of love story. And yet, it might be surprising to some of our listeners out there that the relationship depicted here in this very strange story can be relatable. Can it? Yes. That's the way it is with stories. As Peter Orner surmises here, stories are very singular things. They can answer questions that we've been trying to answer for a long time or didn't even know we needed an answer for. The narration in the story is another thing that sets it apart. We start in a first-person point of view. Then the narrator directly addresses the reader as you, as in a dramatic monologue. Then the narration shifts to third person, and the narrator refers to a character named Ron. He then, however, shifts back to first person, and then things alternate some more. This becomes then a very meta narrative, and one where we can try to decipher what all the shifting perspectives can contribute to how we understand the story. Why does the narrator do this shifting? Well, it could be that he's creating distance between himself and the rather difficult thing that ultimately occurs between Sarah Cole and himself, Sarah Cole and Ron. It could be that Ron simply cannot face what he did. Maybe Sarah changed him. And here's this. Our narrator is extremely attractive. Sarah Cole is not. But she approaches him one day in a bar, and he responds to her. She sees him. That's important. She sees him in the bar that day. And he has to look at her. And then he sees her. Maybe he lays eyes on her unattractive features, yes, but somehow he also sees her. And is this openness and honesty a way into love? Maybe. Maybe it's the only way. In love, openness and honesty are tenuous, fragile things that can die. Love can die if we aren't careful with it. And what is it that makes love take hold to begin with? And as for this shifting perspective and this unreliable narrator, what is the truth here? Who's being honest? Is Ron good looking? Probably. So why is he alone in the world? Why does it take the homeliest woman he has ever seen to make him look up from his routine and see someone else? Someone who has lost at love before too, but still has love to give. At the end of the story, does Sarah Cole really turn into the most beautiful woman Ron has ever seen? Is it a love story? Can it be? Let's find out. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss Sarah Cole, A Type of Love Story by Russell Banks. Okay, so Sarah Cole.
I don't mean to diss this story, you know. I mean, it's a great story. It's a great story. And I.
Well, and the other thing about it is that I accept it as a story, and I accept these things as they, not as they happened, but as they are being shared by this person who's obviously having a hard time with what occurred. For that reason, I appreciate it. Like, I walk into the story already knowing that maybe it didn't happen quite this way, and that's the point for me, is I'm really focused on the person telling the story and how the problems are all with him.
I mean, and you are not alone. This is a story that really, really gets under people's skin. So I'm trying to, I don't know, because you, like you said, like you read it again and it blew you away again.
Yeah.
So like, as a first timer, I'm a first timer on Sarah Cole, a Kind of Love Story. This, so, you know, I just met a friend in the hallway who said he's been teaching the story for 20 years. And he like swooned when I said it. You know, kind of like you, like he's like, oh, Sarah Cole was right. And then he started to, you know, it was Tommy O'Malley. And he said something to the effect of, the guy is so repulsive and yet his confession is so moving or something. And so I'm trying to join you guys.
Okay, that's quite an endorsement from Tommy. So that's really good to know. We're in good company. Okay, so this is a story about this guy who immediately in the first paragraph tells us that he's really good looking. He was really attractive 10 years ago. And he's sharing a story about Sarah Cole, who was the very homely person and very unattractive.
The homeliest person I have ever known.
Yeah.
Personally, I mean, I've seen a few women who are more unattractive than Sarah, but they were freaks of nature or had been badly injured or had been victimized by some grotesque, disfiguring disease. Now, again, you could pick off this, you know, like that doesn't represent the story, but that is in the story.
That is the first thing we learn. And right off the bat, as a reader, I'm thinking, was he really that good looking? And was she really that homely? Right off the bat. So I know we don't want to talk about Kraft too much, but the unreliable narrator in this story, for me, is really important. Like, it's just this thing that I have to look at very, very closely. And it's not just that the guy can't tell the truth to save his life, or he doesn't even really see the truth in front of him, or he can't even help himself but embellish or revise the facts. But it's, for me, that's the point. Is that complication, that fact of human beings who do this as a way to protect themselves or whatever. You know, and then I have to really think about whether or not this is a love story. And who is the object of love here and who isn't. And sometimes I think that this kind of self-protection is about how he just is so self-loathing, but it doesn't necessarily mean he loves her. And I don't want to get too into the weeds with that stuff, but...
Forgive me my contrarian morning.
Okay.
Because I absolutely read it as a love story. It is a love story. Of course it's a love story. What a type of love story is almost like a complete, like, you know, so this is why it's a very appropriate story for Valentine's Day. This is a love story. We've talked about this before, this idea of unreliable narrators. And I'm always like, you know, find me the reliable narrator. Find me the Moses of narration or Moses isn't reliable. He makes up stuff, doesn't he? You know, I just, where's the objective, scientific, you know, absolutely true fictional narrator? They don't exist. And so I'm taking this story at its absolute face value. It's a love story between a very handsome man and a not attractive woman in his eyes. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a, you know, it's an interesting story to talk about in 2025. And, or, you know, I'm like, Tommy, you teach this? I'm like, come on. But like, okay. And yet, as you said, like the Kraft angle, which I think is always interesting, is a story, a first person story. You're always trapped in the mind of the teller. And it just kind of depends on how transparently you call it unreliability. And that's definitely one way of seeing it. I would say how transparently mm-hmm. you're trapped inside your head. Some first person narrators, you know, can kind of play the game of pretending to be otherwise. But like if you think of like a narrator like the lawyer, and now I'm getting real pedantic, but the lawyer in Bartleby, where he's trapped in his head, I kind of see that this story is almost like that. Like he's utterly trapped in his own way of seeing this. And yet I'm believing everything in the story, and I don't unbelieve in it. I don't not believe any of it.
So when he shifts from that first person point of view at the beginning, he shifts to referring to himself as Ron. Our man, call him Ronald, Ron, in most ways, is like these men, except that he is unusually good-looking, and that makes him a little less unhappy than they. Already, I don't believe that, but anyway, Ron...
It's also funny. I think we should say this is...
It's funny.
This is a funny story. I mean, it's a... Yeah.
Ron is effortlessly attractive, a genetic wonder, tall, slender, symmetrical, and clean. His flaws, a small mole on the left corner of his square, not too prominent chin, a slight excess of blonde hair on the tops of his tanned hands, and somewhat underdeveloped buttocks, insofar as they keep him from resembling too closely a men's store mannequin, only contribute to his beauty, for he is beautiful, the way we usually think of a woman as being beautiful. And he is nice, too. The consequence, perhaps, of his seeming not to know how beautiful he is to men as well as women, to young people, even children as well as old, to attractive people who realize immediately that he is so much more attractive than they as not to be competitive with them, as well as unattractive people. That paragraph, we establish what a good-looking guy he thinks he is or was 10 years ago.
Yeah, and then, you know, and he meets Sarah in the bar in Concord, New Hampshire. One of the things I really admire about this story is where it's set. Concord is it's almost a character in the story by not being a character, you know, a kind of no place. But as Russell Banks for sure knew, Concord wasn't no place, and it feels. Some of the specificity of what part of town they live in and where they go and the restaurants they go to, it completely nails Concord, where which is about 40 miles from where I'm sitting. And I've been there many times, and it just feels like Russell Banks loved the place and knew it and knew that he couldn't pretend it wasn't anything other than it was. It's a real town.
Mm-hmm. But I do like that that the narrator sort of plays with the idea, like, well, let's just call it Concord. Like, it might not be.
It happened to have taken place in Concord, so we'll just say that.
And then there are things that are not so specific that are really quite generic. But then I want to talk. So we know what he looks like. So when he's sitting in this bar reading the paper, then it says, when the woman who will turn out to be Sarah Cole leaves a booth in the back and approaches him, she comes up from the side and sits next to him. That's very interesting that she's the one that approaches him, this beautiful, super attractive man. She's wearing heavy tan cowboy boots and a dark brown suede cowboy hat, lumpy jeans, and a yellow t-shirt that clings to her arms, breasts and round belly like the skin of a sausage. Though he will later learn that she is 38 years old, she looks older by about 10 years, which makes her look about 20 years older than he actually is. It's difficult to guess accurately how old Ron is. He looks anywhere from a mature 25 to a youthful 40, so his actual age doesn't seem to matter. And then he goes on. Ron looks up from his paper with a slight smile on his lips, sees the face of a woman homelier than any he has ever seen or imagined before. This is in third person now. And goes on smiling lightly. He feels himself falling into her tiny, slightly crossed, dark brown eyes, pulls himself back and studies for a few seconds her mottled, pocked complexion, bulbous nose, loose mouth, twisted and gapped teeth, and heavy but receding chin. He casts a glance over her thatch of dun-colored hair and along her neck and throat where acne burns against gray skin, and returns to her eyes and again feels himself falling into her, right off the bat.
Right, because people fall in love, right? And it's got nothing to do with this other shit. And that's, maybe I missed the boat on why you all love this story. But I read it like totally, like he's just talking about looks because he doesn't have anything else to talk about because he's essentially a shallow man. But even shallow people, as we know from Chekhov and, you know, Lady the Pet Dog and other great stories, they too fall in love too. I mean, am I wrong?
I'm glad you said this because the one moment where I feel just so, what's the word? Like I can almost believe everything you're saying about it is in section three, at the very end of section three, where she leaves his place, the door closes. The man walks around the sofa, snaps on the television set, and sits down in front of it. He picks up a TV guide from the coffee table and flips through it, stops, runs a finger down the listings, stops, puts down the magazine, and changes the channel. He does not once connect the magazine in his hand, to the woman who has just left in his apartment, even though he knows she spends her days packing TV guides into cartons that get shipped to warehouses in distant parts of New England. He'll think of the connection some other night, but by then the connection will be merely sentimental. It'll be too late for him to understand what she meant by different. That's the paragraph for me. That's the TV guide paragraph. That's where I feel like, wow, he really is thinking about somebody else in that moment. Like there's this tangible thing in his apartment that he's connecting to her and thinking about her in a way that's not about describing her. It is speaking to the kind of work that she has to do compared to the kind of work that he does. You know, this work, this packing of the TV guides that ends up in some guy's fancy apartment, the most beautiful man in the world's fancy apartment, right? So anyway, just that.
But it's not even that fancy. Like,
okay.
Like
he's just a guy.
Some guy who's a lawyer who's pretty good looking living in Concord, and his wife has gone to New York and left him, and he didn't really care because he's doing his thing. He's just doing his thing, and I agree with you. I think section three is the place where the story, I was like, oh, I see why.
Uh-huh.
I'm starting to see why this story resonates with people. She has come over to the apartment, and they've had this conversation. And Sarah tries to cross her legs, but she's sitting too low in the chair. I mean, this is a painful paragraph. Sarah tries to cross her legs, but she's sitting too low in the chair, and her legs are too thick at the thighs, so she ends after a struggle with one leg in the air and the other twisted on its side. She looks as if she's fallen from a great height. This is all just like she's trying to adjust herself in the chair. And Ron, presumably, well, it is Ron observing this. Like he is, I call him shallow because he is, but he's also not unobservant either. And he seems to kind of be fascinated by Sarah, like happens when you fall in love with somebody. He can't believe, and maybe we can't believe, in this society or whatever, that this is even possible. That this handsome man who looks like a mannequin from the store could possibly, you know, fall in love with somebody who is 10 years older, but looks 20 years older, who's overweight and has a gap tooth and is poor and is raising three kids on her own. You know, in a way, this story is almost like a weird American fantasy.
And he's the one who is kneading her doughy shoulders. And then she says, "You and me, Ron, we're real different." She glances at the bicycle in the corner. "A man and a woman," he says. "No, not that. I mean different. That's all. Real different. More than you think. You're nice, but you don't know what I mean. And that's one of the things that makes you so nice. But we're different. Listen, I gotta go. I gotta leave now." So she pushes back, right? She doesn't just sort of allow him to, you know, massage her doughy shoulders or whatever and go to the next step. But she's very resistant. Like she's so realistic about how different they are. And she leaves. And she leaves. But that's not the end of the story, obviously.
Well, what's going on? What's happening in the story? The way I see it and the way I think the story's greatness, and again, this is never going to be my favorite story. But I will say this. What makes you feel alive, Ron?
Yeah.
You know, are you alive, Ron? Are you? Have you ever been alive? Sarah Cole makes him alive, makes him feel alive.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, wait a second, this shouldn't work. And then there's the kind of almost predictable to me moment where, you know, they do hook up, they start hooking up a lot. They spend a lot of time together, mostly having sex. And then she's like, well, Ron, I want you to take me out. Let's go out. You know, let's go out. And he's like, I don't want to go out. And she's like, oh, you don't want to go out? And he's like, no, I'm tired. And then, of course, you know, we all know why he doesn't want to go out. He doesn't want to be seen with her.
He does not want to meet her kids. Like, he doesn't want to take the next step.
No, but I think even, yeah, I mean, the kids are one thing, but I think it's going to Osborne's and seeing his colleagues being there with her.
And what happens when he tells her that he doesn't want to go out? What happens with her?
She, again, becomes, as she always is in the story, a real person.
She becomes a real person, but she's very reactive.
Yeah, I know what you're up to. And so then they start, they do go out.
Well, she does say, she says, "You're ashamed of being seen with me. You'll sleep with me, all right, but you won't go out in public with me." That's not true, Sarah. "You owe me, Ron." She says, "You owe me." "What?" I lay back, lit a cigarette, and covered my body with the sheet. I said, "You owe me. I don't know what you're talking about. I just don't like a lot of gossip going around, that's all. I like keeping my private life private, that's all. I don't owe you anything. Friendship, you owe me. And respect. Friendship and respect. A person can't do what you've done with me without owing her friendship and respect. Sarah, I really don't know what you're talking about. I'm your friend, you know that, and I respect you, I do. You really think so, don't you?" Whatever she is equating with their this sexual relationship that they have, he's not. We know this happens, right?
No, because he's a shallow vessel of a person, and yet the story somehow, you know, and maybe again, maybe, you know, the brilliance of it or whatever, however we want to call it, is that the story somehow humanizes or you know, somebody who we don't want to really give credit, you know?
Yeah. Like, you know, and
am I off?
No. And she does say, "If you don't do this, you're bad." She says, "Or else you're a bad man." It's that simple, Ron. But I was thinking about how, what is it that attracts me to the story? And I'm a little embarrassed to admit that it's almost like a luridness or a weird morbid thing, morbid curiosity, a weird luridness around, oh, like the really ugly girl, this really ugly girl with her little cowboy hat and her little boots and her little rain slicker and all of that, her banged up, beaten up car, her beaten up life, although her kids are really nice. She takes good care of her kids, which is another thing. This is another layer.
But can I pause there?
Yeah.
Because that's the lure. And, you know, any story is going to have that. Mm-hmm. And then at certain points, we almost, you know, we could feel almost guilty for
yeah.
wanting to read on and wanting to know. And you know, and maybe I was feeling for the times that I started this story and never did finish it, that I was like, oh, I'm not going to give into that. I'm not going to give it to that, right?
Yes.
But like, you're reading it with a lot more generosity than I was. I turned my back on it because I'm like, I'm not going to even indulge in this because I'm somehow too good for this. Bullshit. It's total bullshit. You know, maybe the story, its meanness resonated too much. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. and then the speech that you've been alluding to, and I think it's worth reading it because it's so great. When she tells him, "You're a bad man, or else you're a bad man." But you want to read that whole speech?
She said nothing for several long moments. Then she sighed and in a low, almost inaudible voice said, "Then you'll have to go out in public with me. I don't care about Osgoods or the people you work with. We don't have to go there or see any of them," she said. "But you're going to have to go to places like the El Rancho with me and a few other places I know too where there's people I know, people I work with. And maybe we'll even go to a couple of parties because I get invited to parties sometimes, you know. I have friends and I have some family too, and you're going to have to meet my family. My kids think I'm just going around bar hopping when I'm over here with you, and I don't like that. So you're going to have to meet them so I can tell them where I am when I'm not at home nights. And sometimes you're going to come over and spend the evening at my place." Her voice had risen as she heard her demands and felt their rightness until now she was almost shouting at me. "You owe that to me, or else you're a bad man. It's that simple, Ron."
I mean, that paragraph is extraordinary. And again, I think if the success of the story rides on us listening to Sarah Cole, you know, I was thinking a lot about this morning. I mean, you know, we go through our lives and aren't there people that we kind of discard along the way? for whatever reason, you know, and maybe not even cruelly. You know, there's a breakup scene in this kind of love story, and then that's it. And the breakup scene is really, really cruel in this case. But I kind of compare it to just any other breakups that happen along the way, and that we just sort of go along. And what is haunting about this story, I think, is that Sarah Cole doesn't go anywhere. She seems to be pretty lodged in Ron's mind. Now, I don't give a damn about Ron, and yet the feeling of him carrying her around, that's really affecting.
This thing that happens, though, before we learn about the breakup, he has sort of done a fast forward to finding out what happened to Sarah.
Yeah, yeah.
In that section, at the end of that section, he says, "And now I have begun to grieve over her death, to wish her alive again so that I can say to her the things I could not know or say when she was alive, when I did not know that I loved her." So did he? I don't know, but it takes that particular scene and this discovery of this information with the friend Glenda, who also reveals some things to him that maybe he hadn't accepted about himself, where it says about the husband, "He was mean to her," I said. "I thought he used to beat her up and everything." "Oh, well, yeah, he was a bastard, all right. I met him a couple of times and I didn't like him. Short, ugly, and mean when he got drunk, but you know what they say." "What do they say?" "Oh, you know, about water seeking its own level and all." "Sarah wasn't mean, drunk or sober," the woman laughed. "Nah, but she was short and ugly." I said nothing. "Hey, don't get me wrong, I like Sarah, but you and her, well, you sure made a funny looking couple." "She probably didn't feel so self-conscious and all with her husband," she said somberly. "With you, all tall and blonde, and poor old Sarah. I mean, the way them kids in the press room used to kid about her looks, it was embarrassing just to have to hear it." "Well, I loved her," I said. The woman raised one plucked eyebrow in disbelief. She smiled. "Sure you did, honey," she said. And she "Sure you did. When someone you have loved dies, you accept the fact of her death, but then the person goes on living in your memory, dreams, and reveries." So this is part of their love story. This information that he gets from Glenda, this is part of the love story, because it is the thing that makes him understand that he loved her. So it's part of the love story.
Yeah, or you know, the way we do in hindsight, right?
I mean, yes.
I mean, I don't buy it, but okay. What I buy is the fact that that she's lodged somewhere in his mind. Mm-hmm. In poor old shallow Ron's mind was somebody who made him feel alive. That's what I think. I mean, I think this story has to do with the people that we come across that make us feel more like we've got blood in our veins.
Yep.
And that's what Sarah did. And what I appreciate also about the story is it doesn't pretend that they had really good conversations or anything. It doesn't. It just... You know, she just...
They're not frolicking in the, you know, grassy fields with wildflowers all around. They're just... And she approaches him. That's the thing with me. It's like, he's just minding his own lawyerly, beautiful-faced business. She's the one that goes up to him. She's just, you know, gonna go up to this beautiful guy and make small talk. And what does that mean? I don't know. But you know, he noticed her. He took an interest in her. Then with the thing with the car, you know, somebody ramming into her car and denting her car, and she starts crying, and he sort of tries to comfort her, and he has to sort of come out of himself, even though he's sort of watching how everybody's watching them and how odd they must look. You know, this terrible thing has happened to this wretch of a woman. And he's able to sort of be part of that. But yeah, I mean, it is a physical relationship. That's what it is. He gets to see her place. And, you know, her place is kind of like her in a way. And she spends a lot of time at his place. And then when she makes this move about, we have to be seen out in public, we have to hang out with our friends, you know, things start to fall apart, as they do for in some relationships like this. And it's interesting how he structures this, where we learn what happens to her and that they're no longer together, and we learn what happens to her, and then we get the breakup scene. And the breakup scene is the last thing, is the last part of the story.
Right, and before we get there, and you know, I wouldn't say we learn exactly what happens to her. We learn, seems like she moves to Florida with her ex-husband, her now back husband, after the kids are grown up, or some of the kids are grown up, and then some of the kids, they move down to Florida, according to a colleague, Glenda. But she doesn't know much else. But for some reason, Ron, in his great imagination, and this is the limitations of Ron, he can only, she's moved to Florida. And, you know, there's no cell phones at this time. There's no email. This is probably set in, what, the 80s. You know, he's not going to track her down, right? So in his mind, what is it? Sarah's dead. And that, he almost romanticizes that. It was only later, when I could think of her as dead and come out and say it, my friend Sarah Cole is dead, which again, she's not. We have no evidence that she's dead. Mm-hmm. That I was able to tell this story. For that is when she began to enter my memories, my dreams and reveries. In that way, I learned that I truly did love her. And now I've begun to grieve over her death, to wish her alive again, so that I can say to her the things I could not know or say when she was alive, when I did not know that I loved her. Now, do I think he's full of shit? No, not necessarily. Do I think he believes this stuff? Sure, because we do. We lie about all kinds of things to ourselves, especially about people who are dead.
Well, and I also think that if he was feeling guilty about it, this is a way, this story that he is telling us and himself is a way for him to live with himself about what he did. But the other thing too is, I tend to think that Ron is a guy, yes, his Italian shirt or whatever, his bike, all his nice things. But I feel like this guy is just doesn't have that much else going on, that Sarah Cole stands out as a highlight. I think he is so shallow. I think he is such a zero. I do think that he just doesn't have that much in his life. We know his wife left him. And there's something there, too, about how he doesn't fill the space. Like, he's looking at the TV guide. You know, I don't know.
He's a void.
A void, yeah. But that's what I love. I love that yeah. Complexity. I like that there's so many dimensions to him. And even in being a void and talking to us as if he's not one, to me, it's kind of, there's such a richness in that. Because there are people in this world that do this all the time.
I think you're a more generous reader of this story than I am.
Yeah. It's just such a, there's just so much going on in this story. I'll never be able to talk about everything that I want to say about it, but.
You know, in the past, like if we both like love a story, you know, it's like, it's off to the races. And this is a different thing. And that's, I think it's really interesting. Because stories are weird, singular things, and they have to hit people differently. Otherwise, what are we doing here?
Yes.
You know what I mean? And so I do realize that why this story is like, I'll never forget it. Like, there's that for sure. And it just like, I just never wanted to spend a whole lot of time with Ron. I still don't. But now I'm going to carry Ron along with me. A little bit like the way he carries Sarah Cole. Like, I think I'm stuck with this guy now.
Well, you know what I love? That right after he says, she was alive, I could not know or say when she was alive, when I did not know that I loved her, like that part. The very next thing is, the woman arrives at Ron's apartment, we're back in third person, around 8. He hears her car with the broken muffler blat and rumble into the parking lot below, and he crosses quickly from the kitchen and peers out the living room window, and as if through a telescope, watches her shove herself across the seat to the passenger side to get out of the car, then walks slowly in the dusky light toward the apartment building. It's a warm evening, and she's wearing her white Bermuda shorts, pink sleeveless sweater, and shower sandals. Ron hates those clothes. He hates the way the shorts cut into her flesh at the crotch and thigh. Hates the large dark caves below her arms that get exposed by the sweater. Hates the sucking noise made by the sandals. That right after he says, I knew I loved her. Then we're back to third person Ron, and he's looking at her and he's hearing her banged up, beat up car. And he hates everything she is, everything she wears, everything she's about. He hates the sound of her shoes. And she knocks at the door, and it is not going to go well.
You know, it's easy to love somebody when they are dead to you. And it's not so easy when they're pulling up in their car without a muffler and their shower shoes. Maybe that's too simplistic a reading of this.
Well, this is right after, you know, she's been, you know, yelling at him and sort of demanding and saying to him, this is what I want. You owe me this. And I mean, nobody wants to hear that stuff. You owe me this. And, you know, he's over it. Like, at that point, he's over it. And they break up. But this is how they break up. It's just interesting to me, the structure. And he says, you wanted to talk. Well, you wanted to talk. You know, he's just not very welcoming. Yes, but now you're mad at me. I can see that. I didn't do anything, Ron. I'm not mad at you. They're silent for a moment. Ron goes on smoking a cigarette. Finally, she sighs and says, you don't want to see me anymore, do you? He waits a few seconds and answers, yes, that's right. Getting up from the chair, he walks to the silver gray bicycle and stands before it, running a fingertip along the slender crossbar from the saddle to the chrome-plated handlebars. You're a son of a bitch, she says in a low voice. You're worse than my ex-husband. Then she smiles meanly, almost sneers, and soon he realizes that she is telling him that she won't leave. He's stuck with her, she informs him with cold precision. You think I'm just so much meat, and all you got to do is call up the butcher shop and cancel your order? Well, now you're going to find out different. You can't cancel your order. I'm not meat. I'm not one of your pretty little girlfriends who come running when you want them and go away when you get tired of them. I'm different. I got nothing to lose, Ron. Nothing, so you're stuck with me, Ron. She sits back in the couch and crosses her legs at the ankles. I think I will have that drink you offered.
Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. Because she doesn't get the drink, and he says a bunch of mean things to her and kicks her out. And then he looks around the room searching for her after he's just kicked her out. I mean, it's like sitting down. I know people like weep at the end of the story, but he looks around the room searching for her, sitting down in the easy chair. He places his face in his hands. It's not as if she has died. It's as if he's killed her.
But the paragraph right before that, I don't know. Do you want to read that part? He's going to say to her, you need to go. He orders her to leave. She starts crying. She stands there and looks up into his face and weeps, but she does not move toward the door. So he pushes her. She regains her balance and goes on weeping. She knows it's over, right? So, okay.
Yeah, and, you know, there it is. And again, it's a fairly predictable ending.
Well, but right? The thing is, what he says in the next part, maybe we're not going to read it. Anybody who's listening to this must go find the story and read this penultimate paragraph.
Right.
But
yeah.
What he says to her is what he has never said to her. They are the words that everybody else on the planet has said about her, except him. And then he finally says it. And he says it more than once. And in his recollection as this third person, as this narrator, you know, in a weird way, he's, in a very interesting way, he's still trying to put some distance between himself and her and what happened. But he also allows himself to reimagine, revise what actually happened in terms of his reaction to her, not what he said. What he said, but in terms of how he can now think about what happened to her when he said those words.
And you know, thank you very much. You made me feel alive, but that's it. See you later. And she's like, no, you can't You can't just call the butcher and call off the order. I'm not a piece of meat, right? But Ron's like, no, actually, actually I can, and I will, and I do, and I did, right?
But we don't even know that there were other girls.
Yeah, I mean, we know he's remarried in the second to last section, and if there were, they didn't mean anything to him anyway, because Ron, it does, you can't penetrate Ron's skull and be another human being. It just doesn't work that way with Ron, and yet she does. That's how I see it. I mean, I might be completely reducing this story, but it's like, it seems to me about the people that we meet that get through to us, even if we're utterly incapable of being gotten through to. We know a lot of Rons. Rons, if you're listening, listen up.
But this is so a type of love story. You don't have to be the homeliest woman in the world or the most beautiful man to see, to totally understand that it is a type of love story and that there is, a good deal of resonance in it about how people treat each other, about relationships, about the dance that you do in a when a relationship is new, or when one person loves too much, or whatever. It is a type of love story. And that's what I love, that it's such a different type of love story, and yet there's still resonance that I can appreciate.
I'm gonna read it again in a couple of weeks and take heed of what you say.
All right. Russell Banks is the author of Sarah Cole, A Type of Love Story. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.